This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support for our show is from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. If you missed part of today's show or want to share it with others, you can listen online anytime at WRKF.org or on the NPR One app, or subscribe to Talk Louisiana on Google Podcasts. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And we start with Daryl Hurst, who is a East Baton Rouge Parish Councilman. Last night, the council met and approved pay raises for police and city parish employees. And good morning to you, Councilman Hurst.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Well, what about the pay raises? It's always good to dole out money. This is a 5% bump, the first general raise for city parish employees in 7 years. Is that right?
Well, not necessarily for every department. There have been some annual incremental increases, like corporations do. I mean, 3 to 4% per year. But what I will say is, as a whole, yes, it is. And so a lot of people talk about taxation and, you know, I'm so against taxation. But here's the deal. We also talk about the lack of services that the city offers and the overgrown ditches and the inability to find good people to work for the city, or when I call down there, I don't get the type of response that I would expect as a tax-paying constituent. But when they're not getting raises, you wouldn't be on your job if you didn't get your raise either. And when it comes to being a public entity, we require that the public, in most cases, have some sort of input to make sure that the people that work for the city have a livable wage.
Now, even with the raise, the advocate in today's report says starting pay for a police officer with a bachelor's degree will be $43,000 a year. Now, some say in these times that's way too low to get the kind of people we need. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. One of the first things that I did when I came in there, literally within my first week, I sat down with the CAO, Darrell Gibbs, of the finance department, and I said, I need to look at what the wages are for the city, including a police officer. And you know, one of the responses was a typical response that we get, that police officers retire very well. And I want to give you my opinion on that, Jim. They retire in worse shape in most cases than what they started, because if you have a police officer at the time making $33,000 a year, for them to get to 70 to 100, which is what a lot of them end up making, they have to work a 10-hour shift, then they work a 10-hour extra duty, then they get 4 hours of sleep, and they go home to a disgruntled wife who really wants time with her husband, with kids who don't get the opportunity to see their father, and they turn into divorce, they pay alimony and child support, end up having broken families, and end up having to work more because they have to cover the wages and still have broken homes. And my thought on that was, extra duty should be an option, not a requirement to have a livable wage. But I will tell you, I want to applaud Mayor Broome, because out of all the administrations, I mean, she's playing catch up as fast as she can, right? And I believe she's doing a great job. The city of Baton Rouge was just so far behind when she took over. But I believe she's doing a great job at this point to get over a course of time to get us where we need to be. Because I will tell you, that same police officer after his first year will be right at about $50,000.
All right. We've got some ground to cover with Daryl, who, as you can hear, is out and about. Hopefully he won't run into any drag racers out on the roads this morning. But yeah, there are a lot of those out there, as you know. And a listener has asked me to ask you about that, and we will in a moment. But there's been a dispute in the council regarding the makeup, which is 7 white Republicans, 5 black Democrats in a city and a parish. Understand the latest census shows the parish with a slight majority of black citizens. That's up from 46% from the previous census. Do you think the current makeup of the parish council is adequate, considering that they're more whites than blacks?
I don't. I think there's a disparity. I won't explain why. The census says, so I'll give you twofold. The census says that we should have potentially, I believe it was 7.2 or 6.6, but the minimum should have been 6. And those are from the first meeting.
All right.
Daryl, can you hold on
for a second? We're getting some background noise. If you're in your car and you got something going on there like a radio, could you turn it down, please? Because it's a big distraction. But you're saying the current makeup is inadequate because there is now a majority of black citizens in the state. But how are you going to change that? Yeah, and it would seem that people who are in the majority now, the 7 white Republicans, like things the way they are.
Well, and that's for a court to decide. I mean, we voted how we planned on voting, which is to represent the census data. You know, we encourage people to fill out the census so that we can have proper representation. And when they do it, it doesn't mean a hill of beans. So it's kind of like a slap in the face. But Jim, I'll give this story and I'll make this one quick. The year is 1995. And I said this last night in the council. You have a bunch of kids that wear JNCO jeans and have chains on the side of them and ripped T-shirts, and the dirtier they look, with sagging pants, and they were called skateboarders or grunge wearers. In the same era, and all this rings true today, in the same era, you had kids with baggy jeans, sagging no different than the grunge wearers did, but the clothes were immaculate, they were clean. Some of them came from the dry cleaners, but media depicted them as a thug. And it's because of unconscious social biases that we get from media that drives how we look at certain communities. And so in order for us to get rid of the disparities that we have in the city of Baton Rouge and the state of Louisiana, you have to have equal representation to make sure that you have a seat at the table.
All right. You make points, I'm sure, that are shared by many, but how are you going to change this?
Well, at this point, it's up to the court systems. But I believe over time, just being extremely transparent based on the numbers that we see in the growth, if you look at District 8 and District 1, which is Omarosa and Brandon, Noel, they're naturally changing. So whether it's this cycle or the next, you'll get a sixth district, whether the courts decide to do it or not.
All right. We'll see what happens. But do you think it will happen quickly, or will this be a long process?
Well, I don't. I mean, the school board was a quick process with Judge Smith, but we'll see. I can guarantee you lawsuits will come. I mean, we were promised last night by community organizations who've been engaged in those processes previously. So I believe that they're going to be a man or woman of their word, and you'll see, if not one, more than one lawsuit to challenge the maps.
All right. Now, on the drag racing, anyone found in violation of ordinance, if the council goes through with this, will be fined $1,000, up from $500 for a first offense. Prosecutors will also be able to suspend the driver's licenses and jail those arrested for the activity for 90 days. Now, is this going to become a reality?
It definitely is. I want to be transparent. I support it. The one point I don't support is criminalizing a spectator. That was my argument last night. It had nothing to do with the ordinance itself, because I believe the ordinance is a safety issue for our community. So I definitely support getting rid of drag racing. They have tracks for that.
And where does the ordinance stand at this time?
It's approved.
All
it
right.
Got a, so, it got approved last
so
night.
So right
eight,
now,
eight,
right,
8 to 5.
Okay.
I mean 7 to 5.
Did you vote against it?
I did vote against it, only for the spectator portion, though. That was the only reason. But how can you criminalize an onlooker?
All right, but the ordinance, which is now passed, targets spectators in addition to those who are actually drag racing. So there you go. Now, another listener asked about something I know you're involved with. I think you talked about it in a previous appearance on this show a few meetings ago. The council unanimously approved an ordinance from our guest, Daryl Hurst, that allows for thousands of dollars in fines to be levied against business owners if they're emitting a stench past their boundary lines. This is called the odor ordinance. Is this a real problem?
It's a huge problem in certain areas of our city, but it's not just businesses. It's individuals and as well as the city government. So we hold ourselves accountable. We have a lot of third parties that we contract with to do these to put resources in place to make sure that we're not the stinky city. So if we're paying you to do a job and we still smell, that means you need to be fined no different than another business was. So that buck gets passed along to you. It did pass. We have 90 days to put it into effect. We've made a slight tweak to where the fire department will be the one that does the enforcement because they get called on the majority of the older issues that we have in our community. So their hazmat team will be managing that piece of it. And it's really not to fine people. It's to make people be good neighbors. And we have a lot of issues going on with people not being friendly neighbors. And only, you know, the people that care are the ones that are being affected. And so we want to make sure that we are putting everybody in a good position to live in a great place and be able to go home and be in peace.
All right. Well, Daryl Hurst, thanks for joining us on short notice, Councilman Daryl Hurst. We'll, of course, be talking with him again soon if things go according to plan. And we'll be back after this brief timeout on Talk Louisiana with Mark Ballard. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Mark Ballard of the Advocate, the Capitol Bureau Chief. He also is in that capacity for the Times-Picayune. In the old days, there was quite a rivalry between the two biggest newspapers in Louisiana. Now they are aligned, and Mark Ballard is a person who has probably as much to do with what goes in that paper as anybody. He's not involved in some things like editorials, but he does cover the Capitol, and soon he'll be covering the nation's Capitol. And as he's done for more than a few years on our program, he's not averse to talking about what's going on in Washington, and right now that's where most of the attention is. But he writes a column every week, a must-read for political junkies, and a listener at the end of last week's conversation asked about a column he wrote on July 24th about the Supreme Court set to change election laws for, quote, a generation using a Louisiana case, and it is an important development. And one that Mark wrote about eloquently. Mark, your thoughts about the significance of the Louisiana case.
Well, they're taking a look at the Voting Rights Act, or what's left of the Voting Rights Act. It's the Section 2, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was kind of ameliorated several years ago. And the Section 2 is the part that says that minority voters need to have a voice. And in this case, they need to have a voice by having districts in which they are not marginalized. And the legislative maps, the ones that we're going to be using in November, were, according to one federal court, is that they did marginalize primarily black voters, and that there should have been another district. Now, the Supreme Court has picked up an Alabama case, which is has the same arguments to it, and has attached the Louisiana case to that argument, and it'll be coming up in October. The fear is that they will make more restrictions on how you apply Section 2, and then basically that would gut the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Well, the Voting Rights Act is, Mark wrote, requires states with histories of discrimination, like Louisiana, to pre-clear any proposed changes to voting laws and to election districts. And this was the result of what was going on in our country six decades ago. It was 57 years ago that President Johnson signed into law this measure that forbids the use of literacy tests and other methods to marginalize minority participation in governing. And it's hard for people to believe, but in the old days, people had to actually take a test to vote. Would seem to be un-American, but it was in the world as we knew it a few generations ago, and it was just taken as a given, Mark.
Yeah, and that is actually, some people had to take a test. I think that, in at least in Louisiana, that it dealt with this. You know, if your parents voted, then you didn't have to take a test when you registered.
That's right. Mary Olive Pearson was on this show, and she said when she first voted, she said there was a white test and a black test. And this was obviously designed to keep black people from voting in proportional numbers.
Yes, and it was effective for many years. I mean, Jim Crow started, I guess, in the 1870s, at least as far as the voting portions went, and it effectively took the black population out of having any significant numbers. And I think they were like 60-70% registered at the end of the Civil War, in the late 1860s, early 1870s, and it was like 2% when you got to the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, on the abortion front, Gene Mills of the Family Forum was at the press club in Baton Rouge on Monday and took a victory lap, and I guess he's inclined to do that based on the fact that he's fought Roe v. Wade for almost 50 years, and here we are, it's no longer the law of the land, but there is continuing activity in courtrooms. And Sam Carlin a few days ago, Mark, reported the state is paying a politically active New Orleans law firm to represent Attorney General Jeff Landry in the Department of Health, and it's you know, over $100,000 to defend the state on this, and it is an expensive proposition, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, and Jeff Landry's not the first Attorney General to go outside to get the hired guns, is what it's called in the business, and to try to win these cases. I think he's spent in the neighborhood of about $16 million in defending these cases or prosecuting these cases. So this one is going to be basically whether the trigger law has the proper constitutionality and therefore can ban abortions in Louisiana. If it's found that they're that it's unconstitutional, then we go back to the previous abortion access. And this is going to end up in the Supreme Court. They'll be the ones that are deciding, the Louisiana Supreme Court. They'll be the ones deciding this.
Well, in Louisiana, it would appear that the inertia is there to ban abortion, even if there is a brief reprieve. But there was a huge surprise in Kansas, which is a state arguably more red than Louisiana is red, and we're pretty fire engine red right now as far as our politics. Kansas is 59% of the people. They didn't want to ban abortion in that state. It might be a lot closer than people think.
I think so. I think that's what has happened. What we've been seeing is that people, or at least in our states, are against abortion, but they think that maybe this is going too far, particularly with the exceptions of, you know, whether rape and incest exception is involved, and then the total lack of access. And I think that what we saw in Kansas, which is not as red as we are, I mean, not as fiery conservative as we are, they're more of the more moderate Republicans, if you will, although they've been Republican a whole lot longer. But they were looking at the access issues and finding, well, wait a minute, that's not quite what I meant by anti-abortion.
It was 59 to 41% in Kansas. It was not a close vote. But Gene Mills, in his address Monday to the press club, said Kansas is, quote, a weird state. And he said there was an attempt to mislead voters. I don't know how you can mislead them on that vote. It's pretty clear cut. But it's once again a case in which if you lose, something was awry. And if you win, of course, everything was peachy keen. But I think that vote has some great significance in our country right now. And I don't think that the vote would be overwhelming to ban abortion in Louisiana. I suspect it might be a lot closer than people think, Mark.
Well, I think you might be correct on that, but I think that it's how we ban abortion. What are the definitions of the ban? That's where the fight is now, and things like those exceptions is a bridge too far for many people who otherwise are against abortion.
Right. The fact that there's no rape or incest exception, that is something that is hard for many to fathom, including the governor, but yet he still signed the new law. And this is a signature that may end any quest he had, and I don't know if he really did have any, to be a major player in Washington as a Democrat. This is not something that will sit well with the elders of the Democratic Party, Mark.
Well, yeah, I think nationally the Democratic Party is a choice party. We're seeing that kind of problems being risen with President Biden. It's a choice position and not an anti-abortion position with, you know, hazy exceptions rules. So, he's going to have trouble on a national basis. But then, you know,
we got to take a short break. But the number is 877-217-5757. Back with Mark Ballard after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. And Mark Ballard is soon to be in Washington, D.C., and that's where the action is politically. It is the center of the universe, and as states go, Louisiana, of course, is a state that views politics a lot like football. It's an indoor sport, and it is sometimes brutal. But in Washington and beyond, people are trying to get a grasp of what happened at Mar-a-Lago, the former president's home in Palm Beach, Florida, this resort. And it was raided by FBI agents who were assigned to confiscate documents, classified documents, that President Trump took with him on his way out of the door of the White House. Now, some people believe that this is not appropriate, that the FBI is on some kind of a witch hunt, and largely our congressional delegation is silent about this. Mark, your thoughts?
Oh, they haven't been that silent about it. For the most part, at least the Republican members of the delegation have done as other Republicans on Capitol Hill have done, and that is to widely condemn and say that the FBI was politicizing and basically asking for an investigation as to why they handled it the way that they did. We're still kind of trying to get a figure. We haven't seen the search warrant yet, so we don't know quite exactly what it was that they were looking for. And, of course, the president has not said, or President Trump has not said, what exactly the search warrant was about. And so we don't know what that is about, but we do know that there's more than a little bit of an investigation going into what happened on January 6th and maybe connected somehow with that, but we don't know for sure yet.
There are multiple investigations against the former president, and yesterday he was in his hometown of New York City, and he did not comply under oath for hours. He invoked the Fifth Amendment over and over and over, and here's a guy who once said, when you invoke the Fifth Amendment, you're guilty, disparaging the Attorney General of New York's inquiry into his organization's finances. Donald Trump has a lot going on in his world, but he is still king of the world when it comes to Republicans. And anytime he is apparently under assault, he has our delegation and similar delegations across the country coming to his defense, Mark.
And they did this time. But I just find it remarkable how he can widely criticize and then do the same thing and get away with it. That's because he was very critical about people who took the Fifth Amendment, public officials who took the Fifth Amendment, and yet, you know, he avails himself of the same thing.
Now, John Kennedy, I get lots of emails from him. I think you do too, Mark, and he hasn't really gotten into the Mar-a-Lago episode too much, but He does attack Joe Biden ferociously and Nancy Pelosi. He attacked her for going to Taiwan. And remember, John Kennedy, our junior U.S. senator, once a few years ago spent the 4th of July in Moscow. He says, Joe, the great inflator Biden, has been living on the government's dime since the 1970s, and he still has no clue how economics works. Now, John Kennedy served as revenue secretary, as state treasurer, as executive counsel. He's been, he was state treasurer from 1999 to 2015. He's been a U.S. senator since then. He's worked well over 30 years himself at our expense, the taxpayers' expense. How can he point a finger at Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., Mark Ballard?
Well, the same thing is that they widely criticize and then do the same thing. But then they attack those who do the same, use it as an attack for people who do the same thing. It's politics, I guess, is the best and easiest way to say it.
877-217-5757. Time to get in with Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief, Jim and Walker. Jim, good morning.
Hello, gentlemen. Good morning. So, to quote Sarah Huckabee Sanders on November 3rd of 2016, when you are attacking FBI agents, because you're under criminal investigation, you're losing. And I think that says loads about our elected officials in this state.
All right. Well, there is an attack on these investigations, as there were by supporters of Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton complied. She testified, I think, 19 hours before congressional committees about Benghazi. Donald Trump is yet to go before a congressional committee. He seems to be dodging and weaving every step of the way, taking the fifth. Robin, can you get that, please? Taking the fifth. He is not being what we would call forthcoming, Mark.
No, and you got to look at, what's his best defense. And this is his best defense, and he's taking a shot at it, regardless of what he has said in the past. And regardless of his efforts to try to tie the FBI back to what happened when J. Edgar Hoover was in charge, which Congress has done quite a bit to try to keep that from happening again. So it's the best defense that they've got, and so they're using it.
Dan,
and I'm not surprised.
No. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org, our email address, Dan Downtown. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Mr. Ballard, are you saying that when it comes to taking the fifth, Donald J. Trump is a hypocrite?
I'm saying that he says one thing and then avails himself of the right that we all have.
Yeah, he's not doing anything.
I'll let you label it.
Not doing anything illegal, but he has accused others of being guilty because they took the fifth, and he took the fifth quite a few times yesterday. It wasn't like one or two questions. It was, I think, every question. He does not want to talk about his personal finances. And he has been inconsistent on other measures. For years, he was challenging President Obama to release his college transcript, accusing the president of not even graduating from the universities that gave Barack Obama degrees, Columbia and Harvard. And yet Donald Trump never released his transcripts for his 2 years at Fordham and his 2 years at Penn. We don't know that he graduated. Jesse and Gonzalez. Jesse, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Mark. I just wanted to tell you, speak plain truth. I know Mr. Mark might be in a sensitive job position where it might be hard for him to offend one side or the other too much, but it's clear Donald Trump is a hypocrite, and the GOP lacks leadership otherwise. There's no one else there that can step up and do the right thing in there.
Well, politics is full of hypocrites. In fact, even one of my heroes, Jerry Brown, said, we're all guilty of hypocrisy. It's just a question of degree. And I think he's right, but some would say Mr. Trump is taking it to an extremely expansive level as far as inconsistency, holding others accountable on ways that he would never hold himself accountable.
Well, yes, absolutely. But that is what politicians do. I mean, that's the... you're shocked. You're shocked that there's politics going on among these politicians.
And a listener asked back in the day how Louisiana officials were regularly indicted and brought before grand juries. Edwin Edwards once said he was brought, I think, before 25 of them during his 16 years as governor, and he did have four trials. He went 2-1-1 against the government. But today, the Justice Department is reluctant to indict elected officials. Why do you think that's the case, Mark?
Well, I think that particularly when we're talking about the former president, is that you've got to take them down if you're going to take a shot at them. And I think it's a lot harder to do. And they're trying to be careful and exact in the type of evidence that they have when they do make an effort to bring them down.
Well, but state officials are no longer getting indicted either. And as we know, sometimes the indictments met with acquittals, including one Buddy Leach, who will have a celebration of life this afternoon, a funeral tomorrow in his hometown of Lake Charles. He was 88 years old when he died over the weekend. Former congressman, former state representative who was found innocent of vote buying, but the government went after him with a vengeance, and he won, but it cost him politically. I don't think there's any doubt that his career would have been more fruitful as far as seeking elective office if he had not been indicted, Mark.
Well, this is true, but I guess that goes to my point, is that back when they tried to do this, then they changed the laws and made it more difficult to do. That's kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. And so it's now not as easy to do as it once was.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Mark Ballard, and then we'll hear from Elliot Ackerman if things go according to plan. And he is a person who has great knowledge and experience on the front lines of the ill-fated war the U.S. had in Afghanistan, our country's longest war, which ended unceremoniously a year ago. We'll talk with him about his latest book regarding this tortured episode in American history and world history. And we're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and a few more minutes with Mark Ballard. On deck is Elliot Ackerman, a fellow who served our country with distinction as a Marine and then as a journalist. He is one of the foremost authorities about what happened at the end, the not-so-pretty conclusion to the war in Afghanistan. His book is The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan. But Randy and Zachary, I want to slide you in. You've been waiting quite a while. Randy, you're on Talk Louisiana. Please be brief with Mark.
Yes, on the subject of Washington, I refer to Washington, the capital of hypocrisy. Thanks.
All right, well... I don't think it has monopoly on it, but there's probably a good bit of it there, Mark, and I'm sure you will ferret it out as few others do when you make your move in a few days.
Well, yeah, I guess that's part of it, but that's been part of politics in Baton Rouge as well. So
there you go. I don't think there's any doubt. But Mark, thanks. We'll call again next Thursday. Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. Bye. In August of 2021, as the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan accelerated and thousands made a desperate attempt at the Kabul airport to flee before the Taliban returned to power, Elliot Ackerman, our guest, found himself in a place he thought he had long left. He was an active Marine from 2003 to 2009, which included serving as a Raider, the Marine Corps equivalent of the Navy SEALs, and from 2009 to 2011, he served in CIA Special Operations, but in August of last year, he was on vacation with his family in Italy when frantic calls came in from friends and acquaintances. Was there anything he could do to help get former Afghan colleagues and allies out of the situation? And he is writing about this. His book is just out, The Fifth Act. And good morning to you, Elliot Ackerman.
Good morning.
And thanks for your service. Well, you were in a tough spot, and when you got that call in Italy, what was going through your mind?
Well, you know, events in Afghanistan had been deteriorating for some time, and I'd been following them, but I was, brought into efforts to evacuate groups of Afghans out. And frankly, what was going through my mind was just that, I wanted to do whatever I could do to help, to sort of play my position in this much broader evacuation effort, which, people sort of called a digital Dunkirk. And the position I was able to play was just, I actually knew a number of the Marines and intelligence officers who were at the airport and was able to, in this day and age, just get on the phone and call them and make them aware of some of the convoys of Afghans, interpreters and others who were trying to get to their flights. So that was my part in a much broader drama, which was this this significant civilian-led evacuation effort.
It was a danger zone like few others, and some people, of course, did not get out. What do you think happened to them?
Well, I'm still in touch with some folks who didn't get out, and they are living and hiding inside of Afghanistan because the Taliban has been acting out retribution against people they view as having been collaborators with the prior Afghan government and Americans. But even for so many of those who did get out, who have made it to the United States, many cannot work. There are efforts in Congress like the Afghan Adjustment Act that's going to try to put these people, who've already served the United States in our war in Afghanistan, and put them on a path to being able to get jobs here and to become citizens here. And I hope that moves forward because just as much of America wants to turn the page on the war in Afghanistan, we owe it to our Afghan allies who've come here to not turn the page on them and to help them become like many, many Americans before them who've immigrated to this country, great citizens.
The book is The Fifth Act from Elliot Ackerman. He received a Purple Heart after being wounded by a grenade in Fallujah. He received the Silver Star in Iraq, one of the highest honors a service man or woman can receive, and the Bronze Star. His Silver Star was for Iraq. His Bronze Star was for valor in Afghanistan. So he's a well-decorated veteran. And when you were in Italy, was there any doubt that you were going to go to the danger zone?
No, there wasn't. I think it just became very obvious what needed to be done in those weeks. I think what was what the larger question was what was going to happen when the airport shut and you could no longer get people out. We knew that was going to be happening at the end of the month, and we really just had this 2-week window as the door was shutting to try to get as many of our allies out as possible.
Well, both President Trump and President Biden wanted the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan, and Biden, when it happened, said, for the first time in 20 years, the United States is not at war. But as you know, war is a nebulous term these days. What qualifies as a war, Elliot?
Well, I think that's a sort of a disingenuous statement, right? Because we still have today. I mean, we have U.S. troops are stationed in Iraq. They're in Syria. We have U.S. presence in Somalia, in Nigeria. Are we at war in those countries? And why is it that the only way to, quote, end the war in Afghanistan is to bring all of the U.S. troops home from Afghanistan? I mean, if we look at American wars, when the Second World War ended, all the U.S. troops didn't come home from Europe. They stayed in Europe and are still there to this day. Same thing in the Pacific. The end of the Korean War, we've kept troops, 40,000 troops on the Korean Peninsula to this day. In fact, the only time a war ends and all the U.S. troops come home is when we uncategorically lose the war. For instance, the Vietnam War, all the troops came home at the end of Vietnam, and now the Afghan War, all the troops have come home. So if you want to lose a war, the way to end it is to bring every last service member home. But I would argue that there are many different ways to end a war, and that our fixation on having every last American return from Afghanistan is one of the things that contributed to us so clearly losing that war.
Who is culpable in this? I suspect you would include President Biden, but he would not be alone. Who else was responsible?
I think there is plenty of blame to go around with the fact that, you know, we have lost a 20-year war. That blame goes between successive administrations, both Democratic and Republican. And I think it calls into question the way that we as a nation make war today, which, unlike previous wars, we make war today with our all-volunteer military, and we put the cost of the war into our deficit, so there's no war tax. And that has anesthetized the American people to war. We don't feel wars anymore. And our politicians, thus, have a very long leash with which to wage war, because most Americans aren't paying attention because it doesn't affect them. And we want to live in a country where our political class, dysfunctional as they are, have a very long leash to go around the world making war.
What do you make about what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's important to, you know, to remember that, you know, we've lived through a remarkable year, and there's a lot of ties between Ukraine and Afghanistan. You know, last summer, the debacle in Afghanistan was probably one of the darkest moments in the history of the NATO alliance. And you can be certain that President Vladimir Putin, as he was at that point weighing whether or not to invade Ukraine, was watching how NATO performed in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, there was massive underperformance on the part of NATO. And I'm sure that contributed to his decision to invade Ukraine. Now, amazingly, 6 months later, Russia invades Ukraine, and we see in a six-month period NATO's darkest hour, but also one of its brightest, which is the way the alliance hung together in the face of Russian aggression, the fact that Finland and Sweden are now members of the NATO alliance, and we're seeing a lot of strength out of NATO. But I bring this up because it's important to recognize that, you know, issues like Afghanistan, these things don't occur in a vacuum. They occur on a world stage in which all of the actors are paying attention.
The book is The Fifth Act from Elliot Ackerman, America's End in Afghanistan. Elliot, you called it a digital Dunkirk. How perilous was it?
Well, I think obviously it was the most perilous for the Afghans who needed to get into the airport and to navigate those checkpoints. And we saw this past summer how dangerous it could be when a suicide bomber detonated himself at the Abbey Gate, killing 13 U.S. service members and 170 Afghans. So, you know, the stakes were extremely high last summer. And, you know, we were able to get some of our allies out, but too many were left behind. And, you know, we still have a moral obligation to those people who gave good and faithful service to the United States, who right now are living under the threat of the Taliban.
Got about a minute to go, but a listener asked a good question of you, Elliot. You're a well-educated man, went to an exceptional school, Tufts University, and yet you chose to volunteer for the Marines. Why?
Because I am a citizen and our country was at war, and I believed I had something that I could contribute. And maybe it's old-fashioned, but I still think that, you know, we have obligations to our country, and I wanted to serve.
And you did, with distinction, and we commend you for your service. As mentioned, both a Silver Star in Iraq, a Bronze Star in Afghanistan. Briefly, were there lessons learned that perhaps we will not make the same mistakes again?
Well, we already touched on this just a little bit, but I would say this: the single greatest lesson I think we should learn from the war in Afghanistan and the war on terror at large is we should be very much questioning any politician who wants to put together a framework and how we wage war so that citizens are anesthetized to the cost of that war.
Well, thank you, Elliot Ackerman. An important book, The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan. Signature support from our program comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Tomorrow, Jim Nickel will be hosting. Until Monday, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.